Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Gabby Conti.
Now my mom is telling me how upset she is at me, how betrayed she feels because I put her at the worst table with the rats.
That and more, but first, Philadelphia. I, Kevin Allison, am coming to you with an amazing Risk live show on June 19th at Fringe Arts. Our history of doing unforgettable nights in Philly continues. And it'll be your last time to see me in person in a while, Philly. So that's June 19th, Risk, live on stage, and tickets are at risk-show.com/live.
We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Lululemon. 10 years ago, Lululemon created a yoga legging. A legging made of a revolutionary fabric that was as soft as it was stretchy. A legging that followed every curve, felt virtually weightless, and held in place during even the toughest poses. They called it Align, and we've been stretching ourselves in it ever since. Now discover the full Align collection, 10 years in the making, at lululemon.co.uk.
The £5 meal deal from McDonald's. Get a cheeseburger or mayo chicken, medium fries, 4 McNuggets, and a medium soft drink for guess what? That's right, £5. Yeah. It's not called the £5 meal deal for nothing. From 11 a.m. Not available on delivery. Carbonated soft drink upgrade fees apply. Participating restaurants subject to availability.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
Now here's the show. Folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. This is The Beatles with Your Mother Should Know behind me now. And we're calling this week's episode Mommy Issues. When I was 10, I was obsessed with The Beatles. I was always at the library taking out books to read up on them, and I saved some allowance money to buy the album Magical Mystery Tour. And there's lyrics in this song, Let's All Get Up and Dance to a Song That Was a Hit Before Your Mother Was Born. And I remember asking my mom, hey mom, did you hear that? What's a song from before you were born? And she said, how much is that doggy in the window? Well, now there's Google, folks, and the internet and all, and you don't have to run to the library to check things anymore. And I can guarantee you that how much is that doggy in the window is not from before my mother was born. But I do remember her saying that this song, this Beatles song, in and of itself feels kind of like a song from before she was born. And that's to say that today's episode is about moms getting some things kind of wrong and some things kind of right. Now, AI has informed us we might get more clicks if we'd call this episode Moms Gone Wild, which we felt was not quite so fitting. So, if you have a Moms Gone Wild sort of story, pitch it to us at risk-show.com/submissions. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Laura House. But before that, a story from Gabby Conti, recorded at the Risk Live Show in Los Angeles in 2022. Here's Gabby now with a story we call A Better View.
So the last time I saw my parents was a couple of months ago, and my mom brings me into her room and she asks me to close the door and she tells me she has something very important to tell me. So immediately my mind starts racing because the last time she said something like this, she revealed to me that my father, who she's been married to for 40 years now, is actually her second husband. And I was 27 when she told me this. So now at 34, is she going to reveal to me that my dad is actually not my dad? I'm an only child, or so I think. I am Italian-American, so the possibilities of secrets are like truly endless, you know? Like maybe now I would finally figure out why my godfather is so against DNA testing websites like 23andMe. But no, my mom sits me down, and my mother's very petite, and you know, and she's 5'1", and she says to me, I don't know how much time I have left, and before I die, I need to tell you something. Now, if I kind of sound dead inside when I say my mother doesn't know how much time she has left, it's because I have been hearing this since I was 6 years old. When my father sat me down and said to me, Gabriella, I have good news and I have bad news. The bad news is your mom has cancer. The good news is now with her in the hospital, you could finally get that pet monkey. This was the 90s, so this was excellent news. And how most kids always wanted a pony for Christmas, I wanted a pet monkey thanks to movies like Aladdin and Dunstan Checks In and Monkey Trouble and Ross on Friends with Marcel. Like, there was nothing I wanted more than a monkey who would be my best friend, and I would feel like almost like a sibling. Like, we'd get into hijinks together, we'd have all sorts of fun. Well, my mom no longer has cancer, but I never got that pet monkey. So, and my mom's cancer, I mean, my mom has been in and out of hospitals as long as I could remember. She's always been in and out of hospitals. She had a rare form of stomach cancer, and they had to, after undergoing a 17-hour operation, which she will never neglect to tell me was just a little longer than how long she was in labor with me. They were able to kind of rewire her stomach. She lost some organs, and now she has a permanent ileostomy, which is a bag outside of her stomach, which is how she uses the restroom. And many doctors would say that she is a miracle because she really did get this whole second act of life. But my mother, the older she gets, the harder it's been for her. Her mental and physical health has been deteriorating. It's harder for her to put on weight, and it's been really tough. So I totally sympathize with that. However, my mom sits me down and she says to me, I have something very important to tell you. Since I am going to die soon, I need you to know that I will never, ever, ever forgive you for where you sat me at your wedding. They can cure cancer, but they can't cure narcissism. So here we are. My mom, you know, yes, my mother is a narcissist. I learned this due to my true crime obsession and also after getting confirmed by a therapist that is correct. She is a narcissist. But at her best, my mother has always been really supportive. She always told me that no isn't an answer. She's always believed in me. She's always pushed me to do my best and follow my dreams. She's the reason I moved out to Los Angeles. So, you know, I have a very complicated relationship with her because in some ways, she's my biggest fan, but in other ways, she's also my worst enemy. And I've been kind of navigating that my whole life. And now when I tell you that my mother will never forgive me for where I sat her at my wedding, and I told you I was Italian-American, you're probably imagining this big 200-person plus wedding, right? With all these tables. But no, my husband and I got married last October at a very, you know, small wedding at my hometown in Westport, Connecticut, because my mom can't travel. We got married in this beautiful, white, picturesque church. And then we had a dinner at this really great restaurant in a private dining room that could only seat 30 people. 28 guests were what we had, and most of them were my mom's friends. So, and there were only three tables. There was the table in the front, the first table where my mom, her friends, and my new in-laws sat. There was a table in the middle where my husband, I, and our the few friends we were able to invite sat. And then there was the back table, the third table, where some of our aunts, uncles, and cousins sat. Now, my husband has an older brother who was his best man at the wedding. I am an only child who never got that pet monkey. So I didn't have any siblings. And the closest thing I ever had to siblings growing up were my first cousins, who are twins, and I always thought I was the third twin. Turns out that's not a thing. And so they were the closest experience I ever had to siblings, and I loved their mother, my godmother, my mother's sister. She was like a second mother to me, and when my mom was sick for most of my childhood, my godmother and also my grandmother would often step in and fill in that role of mother, so they meant a lot to me. But by the time I was a freshman in high school, my grandmother actually passed away. And at my grandmother's funeral, my mother and her sister, my godmother, got into this explosive fight, as you do at an Italian funeral. And I was not allowed to ever speak to my godmother or my cousins again until my mother revealed to me that my father is her second husband. So I got on Facebook and I friended my godmother and my cousins. And I made my mom be friends with her sister again after 12 years of not speaking to each other. And we had the first Christmas together that we had in those 12 years. And while we'll never get those 12 years back, I'm so lucky that they are in my lives again. I'm so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful that I get to eat my aunt's tiramisu again, because it's clearly the best, hands down. And so at my wedding, when we were kind of, you know, figuring out like who's coming, and 28 people is really not a lot for a wedding. Like that number goes like really quickly. I knew I needed to have my godmother and my cousins there. That was important. And while most brides up until their wedding, they're stressed about things like their dress, their hair, their makeup, their flowers. Like the only thing that was stressing me out was that my mother was going to get into a Jersey Shore meets Real Housewives of New Jersey meets Sopranos, like, style fight with her sister in front of my new in-laws, quiet, mild-mannered people from Indiana who call Italians Italians and who I'm pretty sure have never, like, raised their voice in their life. So that was the biggest fear that consumed me, and that fear would keep growing and growing. My mom would call me out of nowhere and yell at me and say, you know, how I had to uninvite my godmother, I had to uninvite my cousins. But my husband and I, we like really stood firm on that. We really wanted them to be there. It was very important to me. I wasn't going to let my mother take this away from me. Like, she took away my relationship with them for the past 12 years. So I stood my ground on that. And up until the wedding, on the wedding day, I was so nervous. And my husband and I, nights before the wedding, were working on this seating chart, like trying to figure out every single possible way of how we could seat people so my mother and my aunt, her sister, are the furthest possible way they could be from each other. And the way we could do that was by putting my mom at the front first table and my aunt in the back. Turns out that was wrong. That was very wrong, which I guess I should have known, because growing up, my mom has always been the type of person to always change her table like millions of times when we go to a restaurant. And going to hotels with her as a kid, my dad and I would sit in the lobby and wait for her to find the best room with the best view. Although, like, how often are you looking out the window when you're on vacation? So I should have known that this table wasn't the best, because the table where I actually sat my aunt overlooked the restaurant. So I guess technically that had the best view, and that's where my mom wanted to be seated. But like, I didn't know that at the time. And I thought, thanks to lorazepam, that my mom was fine with this table arrangement, because she was at my aunt's table. She was acting like best friends with her sister. And I was like, finally, this feud is over. Turns out, no, it isn't. She just wanted to be at the table with the better view. So now my mom is telling me how upset she is at me, how betrayed she feels because I put her at the worst table with the rats. That's a direct quote. I'm pretty sure there are no rats at one of the best restaurants in Westport, Connecticut, Martha Stewart's former hometown. Pretty sure they're not there. But she was so mad, and she just kept yelling at me and yelling at me about how upset she was. And I realized something here. I realized that my mom is right. She doesn't have a lot of time left. And in the past, I would spend a lot of this time arguing back with her, yelling back with her. And I never realized that my mom could just get into an argument with herself if I just didn't say anything back. And so that's what I did. I left the room and I let her just yell at herself about how angry she is about the situation, about how she was sitting with the rats, about how much she hates my aunt, how much she hates me. And not to like accuse her behavior, but I like to say, you know, I understand like, I don't understand. I don't know what it's like to be my mother. I don't know what it's like to have an ileostomy. I don't know what it's like to wake up every day and not know if that day is your last. Actually, I kind of do, thanks to the pandemic. But I don't know what she goes through. And I know she's angry. And I think that she is putting her anger on me. And I also don't know how many more nights I will get a good night, sweetheart, superstar, love you, you're the best, with all the emojis and all caps text messages from her. Like, I don't know how much longer that is. But, and also those text messages depends on whether or not she likes me or not that night. I got one last night, so we're good. But I don't know. And all I know is that I can't control her. I can only control myself and how I react to her. So I am choosing to only react to her with love because that's all I can do. And also knowing that even though she's my mother, I now have my new family with my husband and our cat, Owen. And maybe someday we'll expand our family and finally get that pet monkey. Thank you.
Okay, everyone, so look at the numbers from Q1 and you'll see that there's a sharp...
Alex? Oh, I think you're frozen.
And that's why it's crucial that we make...
Eh, that sounded important.
Because if we don't act now...
We've lost him.
Bring an end to work call interruptions with EE Wi-Fi Enhancer. More work from homers are choosing EE Broadband, the UK's fastest growing broadband provider.
And he's back.
So I hope that was all clear.
To verify, see ee.co.uk/claims.
I'm CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Major Garrett, and you're invited to The Takeout. No reservations required. Every weeknight, our podcast serves up a balanced menu of politics, policy, and pop culture. The day's happenings with curiosity, informality, and humor. Serious discussion, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. Follow and listen to The Takeout with me, Major Garrett, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
Risk. This is Alabama 3 behind me now, and we just heard from Gabby Conti, the writer and executive producer of the 9-part rom-com for your ears podcast called Bad Influencer, and she's the author of the enormously popular book 20 Guys You Date in Your 20s. You can find her on Instagram at It's Gabby Conti. Folks, one way I've been trying to raise money for my move in the fall is that I've started teaching storytelling workshops again for the first time in 10 years, but this time online, right there on Zoom. And here's the deal. My move to Bangkok has just been delayed 1 month, so I'm now able to offer at least one and maybe even two more of these online workshops. I figure these will most likely be either Sunday mornings around 10 a.m. Eastern or Wednesday or Thursday evenings around 6:30 p.m. Eastern, but they haven't been scheduled yet. So email me if you're interested at all, kevin@risk-show.com, and spread the word. Let me tell you, these first workshops I've taught so far have just been so beautiful. People share stories in the 5-minute range or the 15-minute range, and just like stories on Risk, some make us cry, some make us laugh, some make us feel all warm and fuzzy, some are scary. And the vibe is just so supportive and encouraging. People have been saying it's a bit like group therapy, but where sharing stories is the key. Some folks have worked on stories for their family, things that they want to share with their family. Others, things that they want to do career-wise, you know, stories to share somewhere in their field. Many work on stories they'd like to share on stage or on a podcast like Risk. And some don't really have, you know, plans. They're there because it's a creative and it's good for your mental health. It's connecting with others in such a positive way. And by the way, if you think you might be too nervous or shy, or you're just convinced, no, there's no helping me, I suck at storytelling, jump on in, because it's downright uncanny how often it's the people who say, at least at the start of the workshop, how terrible they think they are and how shy they are, etc., etc., who become the most beloved by their classmates and often tell the most amazing stories. And one last thing. As you know, Risk developed a curated social event that we call What's Your Story. It's a very low pressure, fun event that we normally do in an empty theater or a bar, where the whole idea is just to get people sharing very short, mostly light and fun stories. It's not a workshop. It's a have fun meeting people sort of event where there's no big awkward pauses because myself or someone else from the Risk team is leading these quick, bite-sized storytelling activities. And some people love the event so much that they come back every time we do it in New York. Well, before I moved to Bangkok, I thought I should also host one of these What's Your Story events online, or maybe a few. So we've never done What's Your Story online before. I think it would be quite successful. So if you're interested in a What's Your Story online event, email me about that also at kevin@risk-show.com. Now, I haven't scheduled one yet. I'm trying to garner if people would be interested in attending one. But I'll start creating a list of people who email me and show interest. Okay, that was a lot. Okay, next we're going to hear from Jade Green. Here she is now with a story we call Crime and Codependency.
My mom taught me how to steal. Her name is Rose, and it was just me and her growing up. Single parent, only child, household. Ever since I was little, for as long as I can remember, every time we'd go shopping, She would change labels on things to make them cheaper. I remember this starting with clothing, which is the easiest thing to change a label on because you can find a, you know, full price item and then go and have a little look in the sales section and find a discount label. And then you can just sneak into the changing rooms. I hope I'm not giving the listeners any ideas because it's not a good thing. This isn't going to a good place, so I'm not condoning this, obviously. So I got really used to being with her in the shop while she did this, come with her to the changing rooms and she'd do it. And at some point, she graduated from clothing to other items, riskier items like food and homewares, just anything she wanted, really. I'm from a place called Coventry, which is this quite grim city in the West Midlands in England. It's this landlocked place where the only thing to do really is shop. Like, that's what you do at the weekends, is you go out to the shops and buy things. And so we spent a lot of time doing that. And obviously I got very used to never paying full price for anything from a very young age. And like I said, she did this with everything. I remember she did it with like a Christmas ham one year. Find a Christmas ham and then go and find a discounted food item and peel the label off and stick it on the ham. I think in her mind, she didn't really see this as stealing. I think because she was paying some money for the item, you know, it's not the same as just shoplifting it. And she always had this thing of, if you're doing it with like a big chain store, a big corporation, like it doesn't count, it's fine. You know, what do they care? They just make slightly less money and it's fine. You know, she's a single mom, we're poor, you know, we need the help and it's fine. That was really the belief that was ingrained throughout my childhood and teenage years. And so at a certain point, obviously, I started doing this too as a way of sort of, you know, copying her, and because it was so normalized. And I got really good at it as well from watching her. And she did occasionally get caught as well, you know, go to the checkout and she'd try and purchase the fake sale item, and the checkout person, if they were good, we call it a job's worth in this country. It's where like someone's, you know, takes pride in like following the rules in their job, and if they see you trying to get away with doing this sort of scam that she was pulling, they're gonna tell the manager. And she had this whole performance that she did when she got caught, which was this sort of pearl clutching, like, oh, how could you possibly accuse me of doing this sort of performance, which I found so embarrassing standing next to her in the shop while she did this. I would just be sort of cringing on the spot and just want to get out of the shop as quickly as possible. But she was good at this performance. If you met her, you wouldn't think that she was like this because she's just sort of quite a kind person. You know, she doesn't seem like the kind of person who would be doing this. But I guess being in these situations, I think it gave her a kind of sense of power or like control, as well as, I guess, the thrill of doing it. It's a buzz that you get from it. Looking back on her own upbringing, she grew up on this farm in rural Coventry with 9 other siblings. And her mum was really, really tough, really strict, disciplinarian. There was physical discipline of all kinds, and it was brutal, you know, from what I've heard from her and her siblings. It was a really brutal upbringing. Obviously, that had an impact on her, had an impact on everyone in my family. And so I always kind of theorized that the stealing was a way of, I don't know, acting out or like I said, feeling in control when, you know, when she was younger, she just had no control. She had no power in that house. And within my family, everyone knew that she stole, and it was kind of a joke. It was something laughed about. You know, when she would go shopping with her sisters, she would change labels on things for them, and so they would benefit from this scheme as well. It was just not seen as breaking the law or doing something wrong. In terms of our relationship, one of the impacts of her really tough upbringing was that when she had me, there were no rules. You know, there were no boundaries in our house. I was pretty much allowed to do whatever I wanted. And so I did all of the usual stupid teenage things that people do with no consequences. You know, I never faced any kind of punishment. It was very free kind of household, and she saw us as more like friends than mother and daughter, and I think that was a way that she could like not have to set any kind of boundaries with me. So I get to around 18, I'm getting ready to go off to university. Like I said, I've never been punished for anything, never faced any consequences. I've never learned that stealing is bad, that lying is bad. And so I'm going off into the world with this mindset of what is okay and what isn't. And I had quite a tough time at university. Mental health was really not great in those days. You know, I found it a lonely place. I didn't find it easy to make friends. I'm autistic, so it's like sensory overload of this new environment, new people. It's loud and unfamiliar. And so I was quite depressed during that time. I met this guy called James, and he was sort of lost as well. You know, we were both two lost people in this strange city coming together. It was that kind of relationship, where we were finding that solace in each other, finding, you know, a place to be. And it was not long into our relationship, at whatever stage you start to go like food shopping together, that I noticed that he had his own scheme for stealing. It's different to my mum's, but how interesting that I was drawn to someone who was also acting out in that way. So his scheme was that he was able to cheat the scales on the self-service checkout so that you could basically put through some of the food that you wanted to buy and then cheat the rest through to make it look like you'd paid for it. This was just something that he did. It was fairly normal, and it became a normal part of our relationship. You know, whenever we went food shopping, you know, just buy some stuff and get the rest for free, you know, a little kind of bonus. And I guess we, you know, enabled this in each other, similar to how it was when I was growing up. It was normal. We did this for long enough that we started to feel sort of invincible, I guess, which is probably the stage that people get to when they're committing crimes, you know, on a regular basis. You start to feel like, oh, we've never been caught for this, and it's fine, you know. And I think we got a sort of buzz together from doing this, and, you know, the thrill of it, the acting out, the getting away with it. So I get to the second year of university, and I'm excited to move out of the halls of residence that I'd been living in my first year. And I found a little studio apartment for myself. You know, it's just like a kitchenette and a room, but it was like paradise to me to have that alone space. I have this boyfriend now that I, you know, I'm feeling a bit better about things than I was in the first year. So I move into this new flat, and it's really exciting. And I'm really excited to furnish it with new things. You know, I need things for the kitchen and new bedding and homewares. So me and James go to Asda, which is like Walmart in this country. and it's in this big retail park on the edge of Leicester. And so we go there one night, shortly after I'd moved in to my new flat. And we walk in there. I remember making a comment about how, well, we keep getting away with this, don't we? You know, we're obviously about to perpetrate another scheme of like getting all the stuff that I need and not paying for it all. And I, yeah, make a comment on how great it's going. And yeah, we're like a couple of cocky, you know, criminals walking through, walking through this supermarket as if we own everything in there already, you know, as if the world is ours sort of thing. So we waltz around Asda, filling the trolley with all the things that I need, so like kettle and toaster and plates and cutlery and new bedding and food as well, lots of decadent food for the week. Also just frivolous things like DVD box sets. And, you know, I remember we hid a DVD box set inside a bin. So we were going to like put that through the checkout with it inside and obviously not get caught because we're invincible. We get to the self-service checkout and I notice how eerily quiet it is in the supermarket and that there are no other customers like in the self-service checkout area. And I feel a little prickle like go up the back of my neck, which was maybe my body warning me, you know, you're walking into a dangerous situation here. It always amazes me that the wisdom of the body that it's able to sense that. But I told it to shut up and, you know, the thoughts in my head were still, I'm invincible, I've never been caught. We're skilled criminals at this point. We've done this hundreds of times. So I pushed that feeling aside. So we do the scam. We put everything through. We pay probably about £20 for like £100 worth of goods. Put it all in the trolley, put it in bags. We're walking towards the exit. And I just have a memory of James's stripy t-shirt disappearing through the electric doors. And I realize too late that the security alarms are there and that we've got a bunch of stuff that is probably tagged and we hadn't even thought of that. And I just remember that shrill sound of the alarms going off and my heart leaping, my whole body just tense and in a kind of anxious state. And James is shocked as well and he turns around to look at me frantically. I see the terror in his eyes. And a security guard appears out of nowhere. He tells us to stop. And he seems quite happy, the security guard, to have something to liven up his shift, you know, his evening shift. It's a quiet night until this happens. He already knows that we're guilty, basically. There's no worming our way out of this now. There's no, yeah, we're caught. This is it. He comes and looks at the trolley and it's like, I imagine maybe he was watching us as we were going through the checkout, but we didn't notice him. I don't know where he was, but suddenly he's there and he's looking through the bags and he asks to see our receipt, which I've thrown away like in a bin, like before we actually got to the doors, which is, I guess, was part of the scam, was just to get rid of the evidence of the receipt. So I tell him this, but he's not having any of it. And he makes the decision to call the police. And this all happens so quickly, but kind of in slow motion at the same time. It's weird. The police get there and we're marched through the store, through these fluorescent lit aisles. And the other customers that are in the store that night are looking at us with, you know, with kind of accusatory looks like, oh, look at those people, look at the bad people, what have they done? And we're hanging our heads in shame as we're marched through to the back of the shop, which is like the kind of bowels of the store, these like dark corridors and dusty rooms, and they put us in separate rooms so we can't corroborate our story. And what's happened to me at this point, and this is what happened in those days when I was faced with any kind of stressful situation, is that I've withdrawn into myself. I'm in a dissociative state. I'm only semi-aware of what's happening. I don't even try the performance that my mum was so good at of, you know, how could you possibly accuse me? I just cop to it immediately. It's like, yeah, we did something stupid. Hands up in the air. Like, I'm not going to fight this. I don't have the strength to fight this. And I don't know how, you know, what is the point? As I said, I was so dissociated at this point. I was just sort of signing whatever they gave me. And, you know, I remember hearing the officer read me my rights and thinking, oh my God, I'm being arrested right now. And it's like on TV, but it's happening to me for real. It was just such a surreal feeling. How did I end up here? So because James and I both have clean records, and I think because we're still teenagers at this point and we're students, they show us a bit of mercy and give us what's called a conditional caution, which is you admit to the crime and sign a statement and they'll give you a punishment on the spot, which in our case was a fine, and then we were banned from that retail park. It wasn't until a few days later that I really thought about what was at risk with this stupid behaviour that we'd both been engaging in. I mean, there's reputational risk. If I had been prosecuted, I don't know how it would have affected my studies, you know, at university. Would it have jeopardised me getting my degree? And the bigger picture, getting a job in the future. And there are some jobs in the UK that require you to get DBS check, which is a check of whether you've got a criminal record. And so I was putting all of that at risk and was totally unaware of that when we were doing this for all of that time. I don't even remember leaving the store because I was just in such a shock. I just remember driving home and it being silent in the car between James and I. Like, we didn't have the kind of relationship where we ever talked about things. We didn't talk about our emotions. And so I think we just sort of brushed it aside, brush it under the carpet, not talk about it. And I never told anyone about it because I was so ashamed. And it felt like, you know, most children probably learn that like stealing is wrong and lying is wrong, and you know, they have punishments that help them to learn those lessons. But because I'd never had any of that, it was like just being hit with this lesson right in the face, you know, as an adult basically. Yeah, I just was so ashamed that I think I just went in the opposite direction of being totally rule following and like, okay, I'm never going to lie, I'm never going to break any law, I'm a good girl now. You know, that's kind of the mask that I adopted, I think, to deal with the shame of that punishment that night. My mum came to visit me about a year after this had happened. And she wanted to go to the retail park of the, you know, where the arrest had happened that I was banned from. And I couldn't really say no. I didn't have a reason to say no, we can't go there. And so we went there, we drove there and we walked around some of the shops. And I was terrified the whole time. I was keeping my hair over my face and looking away from any cameras, and I had like different glasses on, and so I wasn't recognized. But the whole time I was just so terrified of like another security guard popping out from somewhere and grabbing me, throwing me in a police car. And it's silly because she would understand. If I did tell her what had happened, she would totally understand and she would probably find it funny, I think. But I was just so ashamed, so ashamed. I've never stolen anything ever again.
Risk. This is LL Cool J behind me now, and we just heard from Jade Green. Jade has a podcast called Pivotal Slice, which can be found on all platforms. Jade's a writer, and her friend David, who is a composer, they share stories about living the art life and breaking down the creative process on Pivotal Slice. And you can find Jade on Instagram at Jade_Green_Creative. Folks, you may know that one of the things I'm doing to raise money for my move in the fall is to offer that for $100 or more, if you so choose, I will meet you on Zoom to chat about whatever you like. The state, risk, storytelling, your life, my life. I cannot tell you how much I love these one-on-one hangouts with Risk listeners. Email me at kevin@risk-show.com if you'd like to do that. Now, last week, a Risk fan reached out to me to do that, and we had such a delightful chat. In fact, I met her entire family, even the dog. And she was telling me about a remarkable organization that she is a part of called No Small Act, which you can find at nosmallact.com. I think it's a beautiful idea. This woman named Colleen Carswell posted a video on TikTok several months ago that went hugely viral. And in it, she was basically saying, what if we created a network of engaged citizens wanting to do this, that, or the other, whatever they could do to fight for democracy? What if there was a representative in each of the 3,244 counties of the United States, and that by joining No Small Act, you could stay connected locally and nationally to a network of people sharing information about volunteer opportunities, protests, town halls you can attend, calls you can make, letters or postcards you can write, offices you can run for, boycotts, petitions, you know, anything. So No Small Act is helping people meet like-minded folks in their vicinity and helping people network and participate in the resistance to fascism in any and all ways possible. So I highly recommend you go to nosmallact.com and sign up. Now, tomorrow, Kate Bohl returns to the show. Oh my gosh, one of our very favorite people and she's going to have a conversation with Taj Easton, another one of our very favorite people who happens to be on our team. But that's tomorrow. And meanwhile, folks, today's the day. Take a risk.